Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 72 and the second installment of our All Things Boleyn series. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and thank all of my wonderful listeners who've taken the time to rate and review the show. Not only are your kind words a great source of encouragement, but they also help new listeners find the podcast. Another way you can support the work I do is by becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's super easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. In keeping with our Boleyn theme this month, May's prize is Anne Boleyn's Most Happy Portrait pendant in solid bronze, made by the ever-talented Lucy Churchill. Lucy's reconstruction of Anne's portrait medal, which is the only contemporary likeness of the Queen to survive, is based on extensive research and is truly exquisite. Thank you to Lucy for sponsoring this incredible prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Anne Boleyn's European upbringing is Natalia Richards. Natalia was born in Derbyshire, spent 15 years at a convent school and then gained her degree in art and graphics. Her first job was as a museum designer, but history was Natalia's real passion and she was captivated by the early music of David Munro and the wonderful BBC series The Six Wives of Henry VIII. No longer wishing to be a designer, she decided to work with objects from the past and became a curator. In her spare time, she loves to walk in Derbyshire, visit country houses, and of course, read and research the Tudors. The Falcon's Rise, about Anne Boleyn, is Natalia's first novel. The second book in the series, The Falcon's Flight, is currently available for pre-order on Amazon and will be released on May 19th. My conversation with Natalia straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song, The Raven, is from the Ballad of Anne Boleyn, Carlene's best-selling album, inspired by the life of Henry VIII's second queen consort.
So cruel and so cold. Hooray, show me my fate so I may survive.
Welcome to Talking Tudors, Natalia. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Natalie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm really excited about our upcoming conversation, so I'm very much looking forward to it.
Me too.
Now, I thought we could start by you just introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about your background.
Absolutely. Well, hello, everybody. And my name is Natalia Richards. And I must just say thank you, Natalie, for asking me to join you here today. It's great. So I was born and bred in Derbyshire, and due to my love of drawing, I actually trained as a graphic designer and illustrator. After qualifying, I became a museum designer. However, my passion was for history, and so I became a museum curator, handling objects rather than designing displays. I worked at quite a few different museums on collections ranging from teddy bears to porcelain. And then I moved to London for 26 years to work with military collections. I loved working with history. And if I've learned anything, Natalie, from my years as a curator, it's the words once said to me by a senior keeper of collections about research. And he said, always remember when reading something, it ain't necessarily so.
I love that. That's fantastic. I'm going to keep that one in mind, definitely. Wonderful. So what was it in particular that sparked your interest for Tudor history?
It was initially from my mum, who at 90 still loves history. And she used to come home from the library with books by Jean Plaidy. And so I began reading those myself. Then at about age 14, I watched Anne of a Thousand Days at the cinema and I was blown away. I became totally lost in the Tudor period. Later, of course, I discovered the wonderful music of David Munro and I was hooked from then on everything Tudor.
Oh, I absolutely love that movie. That's one of my favourite ones as well. I adore it.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is absolutely wonderful. Now, you've written two fantastic Tudor novels, The Falcon's Rise, a novel of Anne Boleyn, and The Falcon's Flight, which I believe is being released in May, I think. Is that right?
That is true, yes.
Fabulous. Could you tell us about these books and what inspired you to write them, please?
Okay. Well, The Falcon's Rise, it sort of evolved out of a previous book. Back in the 1980s, I began to write about Anne Boleyn at the English court when she met King Henry. I then forgot all about this. And years later, when I read it again, I thought, there's nothing much new here. So I began to write it all out again. And this time I started to concentrate on Anne's early life. However, the more I researched, the more I discovered, and Anne's early life began to actually take over. I thought, wait a minute, this will make a book in itself. a story not really covered in detail by other authors. So in a sense, it came about unintentionally, as I never really intended to write about Anne as a young girl. I was more interested in her romance with Henry. So this first book covers the period 1497 to 1513. Anne is living a life of raw obscurity in Norfolk. But when her father moves the family to Hever, the family's fortunes begin to change. Thomas Boleyn then secures a place for Anne's older sister Mary at the prestigious court of Margaret of Austria in Mechelen, just outside Brussels. But fate has other plans, and the 13-year-old Anne takes her place as one of Margaret's maids of honour. However, Anne finds life at court not quite how she imagined, and when she meets the young King Henry VIII, well, I won't tell you what she thinks. By the time she leaves the court of France, she has learned some very important lessons, both political and personal. Incidentally, just a quick add-on, this first book is available this month as an audiobook.
Oh, how wonderful. That's great.
Yes. So, and then book two, The Falcon's Flight, it covers the period 1514 to 1521. And it follows straight on from the first book and sees Anne travelling to Paris to attend the new Queen of France, Mary Tudor. But all doesn't quite go to plan when she meets the formidable Louise of Savoy. On the death of old King Louis, Mary Tudor returns to England and Anne joins the household of Queen Claude, the young wife of the new King Francois. We then follow Anne as she travels with Claude, Marguerite and Louise of Savoy through France, experiencing love, loss and betrayal. At the Field of the Cloth of Gold, she finally sees King Henry again. So what does she think of him this time? Well, I'm not saying.
They sound absolutely wonderful. I think we should all go and get them and read them immediately. Now, the topic for today's conversation is actually Anne Boleyn's European upbringing. So let's dive right in, Natalia. Let's start by discussing Anne's time at the court of the indomitable Margaret of Austria. But I suppose, first of all, we should probably just cover who was Margaret of Austria.
Absolutely. Well, Margaret of Austria was the daughter of the Emperor Maximilian of Austria and Mary of Burgundy. And she was born on January the 10th, 1480. Now, in 1507, she was appointed regent of the Netherlands for her brother's son, Charles, since her brother had died and Charles was too young to rule. Twice married, Margaret was now a widow, aged about 33 when Anne joined her court. She was golden haired and not at all unattractive. She was pro-English, frequently exchanging letters and gifts with the young King Henry VIII, who was very fond of her, and she held a brilliant cultured court at Mechelen. Now, she deliberately cultivated the image of being a very charming widow. This worked to her advantage, for no longer in the marriage game, she was, of course, of no dynastic use, and she could please herself a little bit more. Rather amusingly, she liked to be known as the Aunt of Europe.
Who arranged this opportunity for Anne, and in what capacity did the young Anne serve Margaret?
Well, this was arranged by Anne's father when he was first given his first diplomatic posting to the Low Countries in 1512. Now, Margaret appears to have liked Thomas very much, enjoying wages with him, and he obviously took advantage of this favour, asking her to take on one of his daughters. Now, as to serving Margaret, such unmarried girls of nobility were placed mainly at court to learn good manners. And so, as a maid of honour, Anne would have not had any particular duties. However, maids would have been expected to be pleasant company, run errands, and basically be a very attractive addition to the court.
Okay, and a position at Margaret's court was highly sought after by royalty and the nobility of Europe alike. Could you paint for us a picture of her court and explain why it was such an incredible opportunity for young Anne and for the Boleyns, really?
Indeed, this was a wonderful opportunity with fierce competition, and a place at Margaret's court was really some achievement. So, well done, Thomas. But Mechelen was the capital of the Burgundian Netherlands, and the Low Countries the political and economic centre of Northern Europe. It was a very cosmopolitan city, attracting the social elite and dynamic entrepreneurs. So everybody wanted to visit the Regent's court. Because Mechelen was by no means a big city, but its encouragement of visitors to settle, bringing new skills, made it eventually very wealthy. The palace itself was red brick, and the regent wanted her palace to be an elegant home with an elegant arcade, walkways, arbours and a garden. The bricks formed a diamond pattern, and much of what we see now is as Anne saw it. A visitor actually in 1517 said the palace was very beautiful, but it didn't have much of a view. Well, do you know, it still doesn't because it's surrounded by streets. Now, today it's the law courts. And when researching, I was very lucky to have a private tour inside and see the actual rooms that Anne would have known. Now, I like to imagine the palace as bustling and busy, with diplomats and couriers clattering into the cobbled courtyard at all hours, dogs barking, dispatches arriving, all the latest news landing right on Margaret's desk. Now, since Margaret was a great collector of art, she encouraged artists, sculptors, musicians, printmakers and writers. Her palace was something akin to a giant museum, and I loved it, with hundreds of objets d'art, all kept in small rooms or cabinets to show off to visitors. Anne would have gained a fabulous knowledge of these rare and beautiful things, admiring, amongst others, the works of Hieronymus Bosch and Van Eyck. Now, Margaret's library, famous throughout Europe, was almost certainly inherited from her godmother, Margaret of York, her godmother, who had lived in the palace opposite at Mechlin. She had been the sister of King Richard III. Now, the library was sometimes open to guests, and Anne would have been allowed to read works by Aristotle, Livy, Seneca, and romances, which Margaret particularly loved. Every important work found its way to Margaret's collection, and many were so valuable they would have actually been chained down to the table. Such a palace of learning attracted humanists such as Erasmus and Thomas More, who both visited Mechlin, and Anne may well have heard their religious discussions, and of course, written to her father with snippets of news. Another important figure was Adrian of Utrecht, a future pope, who tutored Prince Charles.
Oh, how I wish we had more of those letters that Anne would have no doubt written home from that ideal palace. What a pity. Okay. So you've mentioned that Anne, you know, as a young maid of honour, would not have really had any specific task, but would have, you know, spent a great deal of time learning and watching the older women. So what are some of the skills that Anne would have learned during her time in Margaret's service?
Okay, well, Anne had been placed at Margaret's court to basically learn the skills that would make her a desirable match on the marriage market and enhance the standing of the Boleyns. Now, continuing to learn French was of paramount importance, since the regent couldn't speak English. So Anne could probably speak some French already, as I don't think her father would have sent her, had she not been able to communicate at all. And she was placed under the guidance of a French tutor named Simonet. But it's her written French, which was not very good, but more of that later. So as well as French, Anne would have learnt the latest dance steps and also how to play a musical instrument. It's probable at Mechlin, when young, that she learnt to play the lute and possibly other instruments such as a harp. In fact, playing the lute was a bit of a status symbol, for it showed good breeding and a lofty mind, and it was considered a very desirable skill to have. She also learnt how to behave at court and how to dress tastefully. Now, she would have done this through reading such poems as The Triumph of the Ladies by Olivier de la Marche. It describes the virtues of a lady-in-waiting and explained how a young woman could succeed at court through good behaviour and impeccable dress. Now, Margaret had a copy of this poem, and Anne may even have read it as a sort of homework before she left Hever. Another useful book she may have read is one by Anne of France, daughter of King Louis XI, known as Madame la Grande. She supervised the young Margaret's education, and she wrote a book for her daughter, Suzanne, called Lessons from My Daughter. It's a delightful Bible of good manners, style and behaviour for young ladies, and you can buy a copy today. It gives a really good insight into what might be expected of a young girl like Anne. Maids of honour were supposed to compliment their mistress in dress and manners. And in the book, one of the bits of advice was not to wear anything too tight or too low cut. So nothing changes there.
Good advice.
Yeah. Now, this book would have been very useful for a young girl at court for the first time. And judging by Anne's later style, I think she took great heed of this. Anne would also have learnt the etiquette of the chase and how to handle a bird of prey. She would have perfected her riding skills, having probably learnt how to ride already at Hever. Although I have said the young maids had no particular duties, it would also have been part of Anne's education to learn how to converse with ambassadors and guests at court entertainments. Now, I think that's pretty daunting for a 13-year-old girl. You know, on public display, she would have to learn confidence very quickly. But it wasn't just chit-chat. Anne would be expected to understand something of the political situation in Europe. One thing I must add that although my books are novels, I've tried really hard to report as accurately as possible what was happening at the time. You know, Anne didn't live in isolation, and I really wanted my readers to get the whole political picture of what was going on when Anne was at Mechelen, and in a sense to know what she knew. So anyway, I doubt it was all music and dancing, for the art of conversation was very important, as was knowing when to keep quiet and listen.
Yes, not always Anne's strong point, Lara.
It wasn't, was it?
So it does sound like she learned and refined many of the skills that would later, of course, make her stand out when she returned home to England. So that's really fascinating. Mm. So we mentioned earlier a particular letter. So tell us about the letter that Anne wrote to her father from Margaret's Court. Quite a famous letter, and the earliest one that we have that we know of anyway.
Absolutely. Now, Anne wrote this letter in late summer from Margaret's residence at Lovere, about 10 miles outside of Brussels. Now, this is where Margaret relaxed away from the cares of state with her ladies. I believe Anne was probably about 13 when she wrote this letter, as I don't think the content is that of, say, a seven-year-old. But, you know, the letter is interesting because it shows she was very clear as to why she had been placed with the regent. She understood her father expected her to come home polished and finished to a high standard, to be a worthy woman, meaning virtuous and upstanding, to be ready to serve the queen at her court. Ah, but which queen does she mean, Natalie?
That's right. That's the big question.
This is the thing. If the letter was written in 1513, was she replying to an earlier letter? And did she mean Queen Catherine at the English court? Or if written in 1514, did she mean Mary Tudor, who was about to marry King Louis and become Queen of France? We can't really be sure which queen she meant. You know, it's absolutely infuriating. We have the place, but not the date. Anyway, Anne continues to admit that her letter is badly written, but she says the sentiments in it are all her own, and she really wants to just get on with it rather than labour to perfect it. So it's not some polite formula. It's Anne's actual own words. And she also expresses her love for her father, a love, she says, that will never lessen, which I think is rather sweet.
Absolutely. I think that's a testament to their close relationship, and I think one that continued on actually when she returned. So that's lovely.
Yes.
So how do you think that Anne's time at Margaret's court influenced her development? We've touched on this a little bit. And what do you think is one important lesson that Anne learned from her time there?
Right. Well, if we're correct in believing Anne was 13, she was just at the right age to be very influenced by her surroundings. She is described by Margaret as being bright and pleasant, and I believe her natural curiosity made her very receptive to learning. And being at a court like this was really up a notch from, say, a noble household, for there were so many important functions to attend. Her later skill in dance, music and conversation certainly had its beginnings here. Now, she was also ahead of the game when it came to really elaborate disguisings and masks, for these had been popular for over 80 years at the Burgundian court. Now, when she came to the English court, the mask was still relatively new, so she would have been armed with a wealth of fabulous ideas and novelties of dress that she'd seen at Margaret's court. And it's this sophistication which later set her apart, and I think she became a bit of a trendsetter. But she also noted how Margaret ran her court. Margaret was strict with the behaviour of her ladies, and so later, Anne was equally pious. An important lesson, I think, that Anne learned from watching Margaret is that a lady could be strong. She had seen the regent constantly fighting against men who would betray her, even her own father, and noted how Margaret held her own and stood up for herself. She handled her father and King Henry with admirable aplomb, and this, I think, was a useful lesson for Anne in diplomacy. Yes, of course it was a man's world. That was accepted as the natural order of things. But Anne saw how an intelligent woman could still be respected.
And so she was obviously doing very well there, learning all the skills. You know, she was considered by Margaret, as you said, bright and, you know, curious and intelligent. So why was she eventually recalled from her court?
Well, this is interesting. To understand why she was recalled from Margaret's court, we need to go back a bit. In 1507, Mary Tudor, sister of Henry VIII, had been married by proxy to Prince Charles, Margaret's young nephew. Now, by 1513, there was absolutely no reason to think the marriage wasn't going ahead as planned. So it is possible that her father intended Anne, or her sister Mary, to serve the new queen when she came over to live with her young husband, Charles, who would then be 14, in the Low Countries. But then suddenly, sometime before July 1514, the marriage was called off, and Wolsey arranged for Mary Tudor to marry old King Louis of France. Now, the Duke of Norfolk, Anne's grandfather, knew Mary Tudor wanted girls of her own age about her, and Mary Boleyn was one of those on the list to go. But Mary Tudor also wanted girls who could speak French well. And Thomas Boleyn wrote to the regent saying that the princess herself had specifically asked for Anne. He wrote to Margaret to say he couldn't refuse the request. Well, was that true, or was he just being diplomatic? Oh, yes. Either way, it was all a bit embarrassing. A bit like saying, well, thanks very much for training up my daughter, but now she's going to the French court to a better opportunity to serve a real queen. What is worse, the French were Margaret's sworn enemy, and she must have felt very miffed at them about to benefit from Anne's skills. So Margaret certainly did not want to lose such a lovely girl. And as it turned out, she did not rush to release her from her care. Anne possibly did arrive in time to attend the coronation of Mary Tudor in Paris, though, in November.
Yes, that's a bit of an awkward situation. Lucky that Thomas was such a skilled diplomat. Otherwise, I don't know.
Well, you know, all that training and then suddenly it's bye.
It is a little, yeah, that's quite awkward. So less than 3 months after Mary Tudor's marriage to Louis, the 52-year-old French king unfortunately dies, or maybe fortunately for Mary, I don't know, and Mary eventually returns home. Why do you think Anne did not accompany her mistress back to England and instead stayed in France to serve the new French queen, which was Francis I's wife, the young Queen Claude?
Well, I've often wondered why Anne stayed and ladies like Anne Jerningham returned with Mary Tudor. And I can imagine the scrabbling about by the Boleyns and the Howards deciding what's best to do here. Should Anne return to Hever, her education not complete? Not much to be gained there, so perhaps not a good option. She was not quite polished enough to serve Queen Catherine, even if there had been a spare place. So perhaps she could serve in Mary Tudor's household. Well, having secretly married Charles Brandon, Mary was now the new Duchess of Suffolk and Brandon the King's brother-in-law. But you know, Natalie, this was a tricky situation. The Suffolks were basically broke. Yes, they had property, but they didn't have a lot of ready cash. Money was required to be at court, where Mary Tudor insisted she outranked all the ladies except Queen Catherine, and they owed a huge amount of money to Mary's brother, King Henry. Now, on returning from France, the disgraced Suffolks had to quietly retire to one of their manors in Lincolnshire. Anne stuck away there in the countryside. Well, she might as well have been at Hever. Besides, another point, the Duke of Norfolk and the noble Howard family detested the upstart Duke of Suffolk. And his wife, aware that they were out to destroy her husband, would not have wanted one of their Howard relatives palmed off on her. Who knows what Anne might have reported back to her uncle Norfolk. So all that was left of any benefit really was to stay in France. And why not? After all, Anne was around the same age as Queen Claude. She was fluent in French and she'd make an ideal companion to Claude's younger sister, Renée. So it was the perfect solution. And so perhaps that was the reason why she stayed.
Yeah, that does make sense. So Anne, we think Anne, and we know that Anne served Claude from around 1515 until about 1521. What are some of the events that Anne would have taken part in during this time?
Oh, gosh, so many. When Anne first arrived in France, she might quite possibly have been present at a really big occasion, of course, the coronation of Mary Tudor. Then when Louis died, Anne saw the new King Francois crowned, and the court became a much livelier place. In the Loire, at Amboise, she would have attended a magnificent feast to celebrate his accession, any excuse for a party, before he left for Lyon. Now, Francois was determined to invade Italy, and so the whole court was in a flurry of war fever, all very, very exciting at this point. There was also the birth of Claude's first baby, Louise, to celebrate. Then, when Claude travelled to visit her towns and people, Anne and her ladies accompanied her. When Francois entered Milan as victor, Anne would have taken part in important receptions, feasts and celebrations. You know, there was one magnificent banquet where the ladies wore embroidered devices and mottos on their gowns, all in the latest Italian fashion. And another event was the magnificent wedding of Lorenzo de' Medici at Amboise. She caught up with her family at the coronation of Claude in May 1517. And when her Dauphin was born, Anne attended the festivities designed by no other than Leonardo da Vinci. held at Amboise. Now, the following year at the Bastille, Anne enjoyed the celebrations again designed by Leonardo that took place to seal the marrying of Henry's daughter, Princess Mary, to the new Dauphin. And since her father had just been appointed the ambassador to France, she would have met up with him that year. But of course, Anne didn't just party all the time. There were deaths too. Baby Louise, the Emperor Maximilian, Leonardo himself. And she would also have experienced the horror of moving from chateau to escape the sweat. This didn't just affect England, but all of Europe. Now, of course, the biggest event was the meeting of King Francois and King Henry at the Field of the Cloth of Gold in 1520, where she would finally have been reunited with her family. So Anne would have been present at some very prestigious occasions.
Absolutely, and met some incredible people by the sounds of it. And it is the 500th anniversary of the Field of Cloth of Gold.
So I know.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it's an incredible event. And yes, all the Boleyns were there as far as we know. So that's amazing. We've talked about what Margaret's court was like, incredible by the sounds of it. Mm. So what was Claude's court like?
Right, well, Claude's court was modelled on that of her mother, Anne of Brittany. Unlike Margaret's Burgundian-style court, this was more in the style of the Italian Renaissance. Now, Claude employed around 280 staff, including 5 secretaries, 4 counsellors, 2 household controllers. And, you know, female staff appear to have been the most numerous. Most important to Claude was her dame d'honneur, then the noble women of her retinue, as well as the female personnel that served them, such as chambermaids and so forth. Officers of the chamber were numerous and included pages, tapestry makers, physicians, surgeons, apothecaries, you name it. However, her household was still only half the size of the king's. Amongst Claude's ladies-in-waiting was Anne de Graville, the only female French court poet of the time. Also the young Diane de Poitiers and Francois de Foix, later a mistress to Claude's husband. Yes, her court was somewhat overshadowed by the figures of King Francois, Louise of Savoy and Marguerite, known together as the Trinity, but Claude was the queen, confident in her station due to her fertility. Now, people always thought she'd be too weak to bear children, but she proved them all wrong and gave Francois the heirs he needed. So Claude's court does not seem to be as boring as is often painted. We must remember that she was the same age as Anne, a young girl, and she loved beautiful clothes. She liked her ladies well-dressed and modest, and she admired the latest Italian fashions. She even had sample costume dolls sent to her from Mantua. Now, at Dijon, the visiting dignitaries, knowing her pleasure, gave her over 55 ells of white cloth embroidered with tiny flowers. So her court was expensively dressed, but never gaudy, just very refined. Yes, of course, she was pious, and she would often spend her time making altar cloths and reading religious books. But this was expected of one in her position. She was strict with her ladies, allowing no dalliances. But then so was the regent, and so later was Anna's queen. Claude was kind, generous, and serious-minded, and she took a great interest in the Royal Library at Blois, with its vast numbers of books and manuscripts. So immensely rich, her court had everything money could buy. She loved to have music, and with her beautiful gardens, I think her court would have been a very pleasant place indeed.
Yes, it sounds like that, and I'm loving the sound of these amazing libraries that these women had.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Now let's go back to talking about where Anne might have visited over the 7 years in France. Could you tell us about some of the sort of specific places?
Absolutely. Now, the places Anne visited depended on whom she was serving at the time. When she was with Mary Tudor, she would possibly have seen the old medieval Paris in the coronation procession. Of course, later, she would have come to know the palaces of the Louvre, the Tournelle and the Bastille and the surrounding districts of Paris. Now, when she entered Claude's household, her movements depended on the peregrinations of Claude, for where she went, her ladies and maids would go too. Of course, much of her time, and therefore Anne's, would have been spent in the Loire Valley, at Blois, Amboise and Loche. But it is often assumed that because Claude was always pregnant, her court did not travel much. Well, that's not true, for pregnant or not, Claude was far from a recluse. Now, following the birth of her first daughter, Claude and her ladies were on the road for 7 months in 1515 and 1516. After Claude's spectacular entry into Paris in 1517, she spent 7 more months travelling to 30 cities in Picardy and Normandy. 1518 took her to Brittany, where the king watched as the city presented its keys to Claude. Now, in 1520, the royal retinue went south to Poitiers and La Rochelle. And in June, the Queen was north again at the Field of the Cloth of Gold. So where she went, Anne went. Now, by the time Anne was recalled to England, she would have made a joyous entree with Claude into over 50 towns throughout France, from Calais in the north to Marseille in the south.
That's extraordinary. I knew she was well-travelled, but I didn't realise it was 50 towns. Wow.
It's amazing. When I got a map and started to plot it on the map, I thought, my goodness me. And travel wasn't easy, of course. No, it was all by barge and rivers, and it took forever.
That's amazing. That's wonderful. So in all this time that she's in France serving Claude, tell us about some of the people who Anne would have rubbed shoulders with.
Well as ambassadors, dignitaries and the most important nobles in France, Anne would have known of, if not actually met, such artists as Leonardo da Vinci. He was invited to live at Amboise in 1516 in a house at Clos, and the king entrusted Leonardo with organising royal celebrations. She would also have known the poet Clement Marot, who later became Marguerite's secretary. She would also have been in the brilliant company of the formidable Louise of Savoy, Francois's mother, and his sister Marguerite. She would have known the famous Anne of France, or Madame la Grande, who had taught the young Margaret of Austria. Since religious discussions were popular, she might also have met the reformer and scholar Jacques Lefebvre, or maybe Guillaume Boudet. So there are a lot of people that she would have known of at the court, most certainly.
And how do you think, Natalia, that Anne's European upbringing influenced her beliefs and her interests?
Well, at the Regent's Court in Mechelen, Anne, as we said, was the perfect age to be influenced in her tastes and later beliefs. She would have seen Margaret's treasures and discovered which artist she preferred. She had access to Margaret's wonderful library of books and illuminated manuscripts, and she carried this passion with her into adulthood. She loved music, and it is possible that Margaret's organist, Henri Bredemeyer, taught her. Now, later, Anne's personal music book contained many of the compositions that she had heard actually at Margaret's court, so she was influenced there in her music. When Anne became queen, she probably organised her own ladies along the lines of Margaret of Austria. In this I mean by discipline and good behaviour. And it's possible she would have admired Margaret more than Claude. She had survived without a husband on her own terms against the treachery of male rulers. And so Margaret was a strong role model for the young Anne, more so, I think, than the reticent Claude. Yeah, Margaret had survived sort of on her own and as I say, was a great role model. Now, as to Anne's religious convictions, although humanism was well established in France, Anne would have heard new arguments put forward by Martin Luther, pondered on the abuses of the church, and joined in, no doubt, the lively debates. However, although we know she admired Marguerite never attacked the church openly, for she loved the old rituals and the order of things. And although she had the full protection of her brother, the king, she kept her thoughts to herself until around 1518, when active reform of the church became much more open. No, actually, Margaret was more concerned with ending the abuses she saw in the badly run convents and monasteries. Now, later, Anne would have remembered Marguerite's reforms when the same problem was seen in England. And I believe Anne would have been sincere in wanting to see monastic reform. Sadly, she was wrong when she assumed that any money from those found unworthy would go to educational causes rather than be creamed off into the royal coffers. Now, education had been a cause close to Marguerite's heart, and Anne took this interest up too. Of course, as queen, Anne would have been expected to do charitable works, but encouraging her ladies to read the Gospels for themselves would have probably come from her personal belief that the word of God should be made available to all. However, exactly how much Marguerite influenced her, we can really only guess at. Now, later in 1534, Anne did give sanctuary to the French poet and reformer Nicolas Bourbon. But I say, you know, how much she was actually influenced by Marguerite, we can't really tell. But she would have heard the arguments and listened to the debates, most certainly.
Well, she was certainly known for debating at the dinner table. as far as Latimer's concerned. So, yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting. Now, this has been such a wonderful discussion. I've enjoyed the window into Anne's European upbringing so much, Natalia. So thank you so much. I'd like to finish with a question from one of our listeners.
Yes.
So Morgan would like to know whether or not you think Anne would have returned home with a French accent.
Oh, gosh. I have thought about this a lot, and I don't think she would have. Now, French was not her first language, and she went to France not as a child, but as a young girl. Now, some researchers say that puberty is a cut-off point for a child to speak a new language as a native, and that puberty was later then in Tudor times than now. So, personally, I don't think she would have spoken English with a French accent. Yes, of course, she spoke French fantastically. After all, she was once described as seeming to be more French than English, you know, a French woman born and bred. But I think she reverted to her English accent once surrounded by English people again. I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
I know it's a tricky one, isn't it? Sometimes when I, to be honest, when I read, there's one letter in particular that when I read it out, of course, they spell phonetically, does sort of sound like she has a French accent. But that could be, of course, just, you know, my imagination playing tricks on me.
I don't know.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Definitely.
Yeah. Had she gone to France as a very young girl, let's say 6 or 7 years old, then yes, I think she would have had an accent. But I think going at 12, 13, probably not.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then, of course, I start to wonder what her English accent was like, born in the north of England. And then,
well, absolutely. I just don't know. But I hope it answers your question, Morgan, a little bit. Or does it confuse you even more?
No, that's wonderful. Thank you. And the last thing that I'd like to ask you, Natalia, is for a Berlin takeaway. So this is just a little gem or something for our listeners to have a look at after the episode. It could be a website, a movie to watch, a book to read. Do you have a Berlin takeaway for us?
Gosh, yes, and only one. Oh, I've got loads and loads. I'll give you one. Okay. A really useful site I discovered quite a while ago is called the Internet Archive, a non-profit library of millions of free books. Now, it's great if you can't afford to buy some of the older books or you can't get hold of them. You can put in a search for, say, Anne Boleyn and get access to all the books and papers about her and read them online or download for free as a PDF, full text, Kindle, other formats. So it's a really, really good place to start, and you can see old books and new books alike. Now, the reference is https://archive.org. And it's really, really useful. But I've got loads of takeaways, but that's just the one.
Fantastic. Thank you. And I'll add a link to that in the show notes so that people can find that nice and easily. Now, Natalia, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking Tudors with me. And I look forward to hearing about your new book and your projects.
Oh, thank you so much, Natalie. It's been absolutely delightful. I've really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.